Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Brainwashing of My Dad, How the Rise of the Right-Wing Media Changed a Father and Divided Our Nation, and How We Can Fight Back, by Jen Senko. Narrated by Janet Metzger. A note to the listener. This book is based on the documentary film The Brainwashing of My Dad, which was released in 2016. Within it, you will hear some references to interviews with various experts that were taken either directly from the documentary or from additional footage from the interviews that didn't make it into the film. Though the main emphasis of this book is on right-wing media, I analyze some events from the last four decades that helped push the country to the right and were made possible largely because of the formidable and calculated influence of right-wing media. I argue that these events were flashing warning signs we failed to address as conservative extremists changed the very face of the Republican Party in service of the interests and agendas of a small number of influencers intent on gaining wealth and power at the expense of the vast majority of Americans. The most powerful tool the extreme right has used to accomplish their goals over the past 40 years has been right-wing media. My experience watching my father, once a liberal Democrat, become more and more entrenched in conservative talk radio and Fox News, quotations are mine, the programming on Fox can usually barely be classified as real news, showed me there is nothing more dangerous and destructive than a media monopoly with a political agenda creating an echo chamber. In the case of right-wing media, that echo chamber is deliberately constructed to stoke anger, fear, and hatred in its listeners and viewers. The most frightening thing about the media outlets that push right-wing ideals, however, is how they inspire complete loyalty and devotion in their audiences. After he discovered ultra-conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh, my dad became 100% devoted to Limbaugh and his school of thought. And once Fox News appeared on his TV, he never wanted to turn it off. Without access to any other news sources, he lost his ability to think critically and question the lies he was being fed. The events I describe in this book should have served as red flags, indicating the changes and division right-wing media was fostering in our society. As of this writing in 2020, objective facts no longer mean much, and most Republicans of today are not the old-school Republicans of yesteryear with their adherence to fiscal conservatism and conservation. The majority of the Republican Party today is complicit in the dismantling of the checks and balances in our system of government, the resurgence of white supremacy, and the unabashed and coordinated power grabs that have defined the political landscape of the past 4 years. Their radical ideology does not represent the views of most Americans and has become a chillingly real threat to our democracy. In The Brainwashing of My Dad, I first refer to these extremist Republicans who have adopted a far-right brand of libertarianism as New Republicans. This new interpretation of Republican values really started to take hold during the years when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House, as the Republican Party abandoned their interest in bipartisanship and began to be more openly vocal against social safety net programs, child labor laws, immigration, energy regulations, and civil rights. Also cropping up during the Gingrich years were what I will call New Democrats. These Democrats signed on to corporatism, free market ideology, free trade, deregulation, and other conservative ideals in an attempt not to be left behind with the conservative turn the country was taking. Still, many Democrats sincerely and with good faith sought to find common ground with their new Republican colleagues, unaware or in denial that the new Republicans had changed the rules of engagement. Later in the book, as the Republican Party continues its shift to the right, especially with the creation of Fox News, I changed the label from New Republicans to Cult Republicans. Cult Republicans share many of the characteristics of people in a religious cult. They subscribe unquestioningly to all the beliefs held by their media choices and their leaders, oblivious as to whether those leaders have their best interests in mind or not, mostly not. Under Donald Trump's administration, cult Republicans dominated the political landscape, encouraged by a president who constantly lied to the American people, incited violence any time he felt it politically protected his power, and compromised not only America's reputation worldwide, but our national security. Right-wing media supported him every step of the way, disguising his demagoguery as populism and normalizing his pathological behavior to the point that each new scandal broke a little more gently than the last. This is a dangerous road to go down. In the end, the message I hope listeners take away from this book is that no matter what political party you affiliate with, think carefully about the media you consume. Engage with a variety of news sources. Question what you hear, especially if the content triggers emotions such as anger or fear. Invest in independent media outlets. It would behoove us all to think deeply and gather knowledge before making up our minds about the big issues our country is grappling with. We all need to shift to the side of truth and demand it from our media. Let's join as one and fight for the common good and for the soul of our country. Introduction. What happened to Dad? Once upon a time, there was an average American family living in an average American town. After the family moved to a new state, the father left his carpool and began a long solo commute to work. And gradually, he began to change. He looked the same, he dressed the same, but something was very different. But this isn't a story about just one man. It's the story of a media phenomenon that changed a father and divided the nation. My family's kitchen in the 1960s looked like many other Americans: scratched linoleum flooring, wooden cabinets with metal handles, a yellow rotary dial phone hanging on the wall by the bread box, its coiled cord stretched and loose from me pulling it taut to try to get some privacy during my long conversations with my girlfriends. The kitchen was always warm and full of the smells of whatever my mother had been cooking. One afternoon, shortly before my 7th birthday, I was sitting at the Formica kitchen table, drawing horses, as I often did. It was late in the day. In about an hour, I expected my dad to come home, and I would proudly show him my drawing. As I was deep in concentration, making sure I got the horse's conformation correct, and listening to the sound of rain beating against the window, the door connecting the garage to the kitchen swung open earlier than usual. I looked up, surprised, and smiled as Dad stepped into the kitchen, his dark hair plastered to his head, revealing his slightly receding hairline. He had an odd look on his face, almost mischievous, and his detective-like raincoat was oddly puffed out around the top. "Frank?" My mother turned from the sink, wiping her hands on a frayed towel. "What are you doing home?" Dad winked at her. He chuckled slyly. "A little surprise for Jennifer's birthday, since she's been begging." Before he could finish his sentence, the bulge under his raincoat wiggled, and out popped the head of an adorable puppy, shaking his ears and reaching up to lick my dad's chin with a small pink tongue. "What? Oh, Daddy!" I screamed and leaped out of my chair, dancing around my dad as he extracted the puppy, which I named Streak because of the thin white streak on his chest, from his raincoat and placed him in my arms. I couldn't hold him long because he wiggled so much. I put him down on the floor where he jumped and wiggled some more. He was as excited as I was. My two brothers and I had been begging for a dog for months. Dad loved animals, but he and my mom weren't sure we were responsible enough to take care of a pet. My mother was clearly surprised by the new puppy, and maybe just a little annoyed that Dad hadn't discussed it with her first. But I barely noticed as I sat down on the floor and let Streak lick my face, breathing in his wet dog smell, and practically crying with ecstasy as Dad looked down on us, his face creased with the huge smile that he wore so often throughout my childhood. I thought, I have the best dad ever. Decades later, that smile would be little more than a memory as my dad transformed into a person I barely recognized, a person who raged more than he laughed, who viewed the unknown with suspicion, and who inexplicably railed against institutions like PETA that protected the welfare of the animals he used to love so much. So what happened to my dad? My father, Frank Senko, was born in 1922 in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, the first child of my grandfather's second wife. His first wife, with whom he had two children, died in the flu epidemic of 1918. The family was so poor that Dad swore he actually walked barefoot to school. The Roaring Twenties didn't roar so loudly for the Senko family, and my dad often told stories about how he and his siblings would occasionally sneak a carrot out of the nearby farmer's garden and eat it raw, or steal potatoes to bake in a bonfire. My grandparents' relationship was troubled, and eventually my grandmother left the family. My grandfather married again and had three more children. By the time my father was a teenager, Hitler had come to power in Germany. Dad enlisted in the army as soon as he turned 18, despite the fact that his job in a factory manufacturing ammunition for the war allowed him a deferment. All his buddies were going overseas, and he wanted to join them. As he put it, America was fighting the Nazis and everyone wanted to kick their ass. He served as a medic in World War II, returned home, and went to college on the GI Bill, earning his master's degree and becoming an electronics engineer. A few years later, he and my mother met in New Jersey and married a year or two later. My mom had a son, my brother Greg, from a previous marriage, and I was born on June 23rd, 1954. On the surface, Dad was living the American dream, but he quietly struggled with his new identity as an electronics engineer and as a husband, father, and provider. His own upbringing had provided no such role models or experience in the social norms of the middle-class life he now inhabited. His poverty-stricken childhood and unsettled home life steeped in old-world Eastern European culture left him ill-prepared to fit in with the other guys he worked with, who had martinis at lunch and knew which fork to use in fancy restaurants. However uncomfortable he may have felt among his co-workers, at home with us kids, my dad was in his element. He talked to us in funny voices and created a mishmash of words from different languages, including German, Ukrainian, and Polish, that only we could understand. One of his best tricks was to burp the entire sentence, "All right, Louis, drop your gun." Whenever someone would ring the doorbell, he would announce, "He just left." No one knew why he said things like that, but he thought it was hilarious. I guess, like a lot of dads, he was a horrible joke teller, but he didn't need jokes. He was funny without trying. He was boisterous and loud and would talk to anybody, the natural life of the party. Dad was creative when it came to fixing things, mostly because he didn't want to pay to have someone else work on them. His fixes may have looked like jerry-rigged contraptions, but they always functioned well enough. Aesthetics did not concern him. he built an insulated doghouse with a shingled roof for Streak and converted the garage of our house in New Jersey to a TV room, complete with 1970s fake wood paneling. He built a passageway from the new garage to the basement, which came in handy during my teen years for sneaking boys in and out of the house. Dad didn't like the wasteful throwaway mentality of most Americans, remembering the hardship of the Great Depression of his childhood and how his family had to scrimp and save just to get by. In a sense, he was an early environmentalist. He wasted nothing and believed in conserving energy, hollering at us constantly about leaving lights on, not wasting toothpaste in the tube, and, the cardinal sin in his book, wasting food. On the rare occasions our family ate in restaurants, we'd have to look down the price list on the menu first before we picked something to eat. As my friend's mother, Mrs. Poole, once said, "My father could squeeze a nickel till the buffalo shit." So, although it was sometimes hard for us kids not being able to get the latest styles of shoes or clothes growing up, he was able to put all of us through college as a result of all that saving. And for my dad, that meant success in his own life. The first political conversations I remember overhearing at home were about President John F. Kennedy, whom my parents adored. I remember the 1960s as a time full of hope, with Martin Luther King Jr.'s activism and JFK leading the country. It felt like we were on the verge of solving many of the challenges that had plagued our country. And my dad was totally on board, an upwardly mobile, registered Democrat who hoped to contribute to a better future for his children and for America. But I wouldn't have written this book if my dad had remained the same person he was in the 1960s and 1970s. Over the next 20 years, especially in the late 1980s and 1990s, Frank Senko, as I had known him, began to disappear. He was replaced by a man I no longer knew, who disparaged the very social programs that had allowed him to create a successful life, who spouted virulently anti-illegal alien comments, and who constantly listened to conservative talk radio and watched Fox News on TV. As I watched my dad change, I realized something else was changing right along with him, the visibility and power of right-wing media. It became clearer and clearer to me that there was a connection, that my dad was internalizing the political opinions people like Rush Limbaugh espoused to the point where he was no longer forming his own opinions at all. He became a parrot of the right-wing media he immersed himself in, repeating conspiracy theories and blatant lies verbatim. And he turned his volcanic anger on anyone who dared to voice a different opinion or fact-check some of his claims. Disturbed by what I saw happening to my dad, I started researching the right-wing media outlets that began gaining power in the late 1980s and gathered momentum with each carefully calculated lie that fell from the mouths of talk show hosts and news anchors. I soon realized that not only were the radical talk radio and news shows my dad was addicted to changing his beliefs in fundamental ways, but they were specifically intended to do so. The simple truth is that while the rest of us were busy going about our daily lives, right-wing corporate forces were engaged in a vast conspiracy to deliberately build a media machine designed to foster fear, anger, and division that would benefit their economic interests. And my dad, along with millions of other Americans, got bamboozled by it. Chapter 1. The Great Depression, the New Deal, and the Nazi propaganda that paved the way for extreme right-wing media. When any of us kids wanted to stay home from school because we had the sniffles, my father would boast that he had never once missed a day of school. Even at a young age, Frank Senko valued education and a warm, quiet, one-room schoolhouse. For him, school represented a safe haven away from his turbulent and poverty-stricken home life. My dad's family certainly didn't experience the roar of the Roaring Twenties, struggling to get along even during a time of relative prosperity for many Americans. During the 1920s, the country transformed from a mixed-market economy to a free-market economy. A mixed-market economy allows for a significant government role. Profit-seeking is not the sole motivation. The motivation is the overall health of the economy. Free marketeers advocate for a strictly reduced government role and believe the market should solely be driven by competition and profits. The Republican Party dominated the White House during this era with three consecutive presidents: Warren Harding from 1921 to 1923, Calvin Coolidge from 1923 to 1929, and Herbert Hoover from 1929 to 1933. Though there were improvements in the lives of some American families with the advent of electric lighting and indoor flush toilets, income inequality was the dark underside of the 1920s. The rich were growing richer, and the poor had to struggle along with no safety net. During this time, the stock market was booming. Opportunistic investors were taking bigger and bigger risks, often buying stocks on credit with very low interest rates. But behind the scenes lay a troubled agricultural sector, low wages for working-class people, bank loans unable to be liquidated, and lots of debt. The Great Depression. The stock market crashed on October 29, 1929, just months after Herbert Hoover became president. Billions of dollars evaporated from the economy as stock prices spiraled, and by 1932, the stock market would be worth only about 20% of what it had been before the crash. Two devastated investors even jumped out windows to their deaths, unable to deal with the lightning-fast downward spiral. Many folks rushed to the banks to withdraw their savings, leading to bank runs and a domino effect of bank collapses, because the commercial banks had used their depositors' savings to invest in irresponsible ventures that had now also bottomed out. Unemployment levels rose to record highs, hitting almost 25% in 1932. The nation was devastated. People were starving. They couldn't pay their rent or mortgages. Bread lines wrapped around entire blocks, and soup kitchens set up by charitable organizations and churches were overflowing with hungry people. This was the world in which my father spent his childhood. President Hoover believed in virtually no role for the government and wanted to promote capitalism and individualism. He believed that banks and businesses just needed to show confidence to force a quick recovery, and that the Depression would get better by virtue of individuals helping their neighbors and people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. But in fact, matters were only getting worse. The jobless and homeless formed communities of shacks known as shanty towns and then as Hoovervilles. Many people felt that the government urgently needed to step in to save the millions of people who were struggling, but Hoover's administration was reluctant to engage in any wide-scale economic programs. The New Deal. By the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected in 1932, the country was ready for change. Lifting the economy out of the depression that the free market economic climate had created was a priority for millions of Americans, and FDR had a solution for them: the New Deal, a series of government-managed economic and social programs designed to create economic recovery and a social safety net for its citizens. My mother clearly remembers she and her friends feeling hopeful as he took office. FDR's first move was to restore confidence in and stabilize the banking system with the Emergency Banking Act, opening the Federal Reserve to supply unlimited amounts of money to banks, and creating 100% deposit insurance. Although this governmental control over banking was controversial at the time, it went a long way in reinstating the public's trust in banks and slowing the economy's downward spiral. Within his first 100 days in office, FDR established the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, which spent $500 million on soup kitchens, blankets, employment initiatives, and nursery schools. Some of the other projects created construction jobs, supported professionals in the arts, educated workers, and gave jobs to nearly 500,000 women. Some of the many programs FDR's administration enacted in this time period include the Civilian Conservation Corps, which gave unemployed men jobs working on conservation projects in national parks and other natural areas, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, which supported farmers, and the Public Works Administration, which spearheaded the construction and maintenance of roadways and bridges across the country. Little by little, FDR's New Deal started America on a new path toward equality and growth. Many of the laws and institutions we take for granted today, including things like Social Security, can be traced to the New Deal era. FDR's expansive vision of a supportive government that extended opportunities to its citizens allowed for more federal intervention to help banking, agriculture, and public welfare. It provided social safety nets, gave GIs the opportunity to get an education or housing, and much more. The people loved these programs, while the free marketeers called it socialism. Very significantly for the discussions we'll explore in this book, FDR signed the Communications Act into law in 1934. To avoid a monopoly on media and undue influence by any one company or person, this law regulated radio, telephone, and telegraph communications by limiting ownership and cross-ownership licensing. FDR had the foresight to be concerned about how much influence media could have on people, largely because he could see the alarming creep of right-wing propaganda going on in Germany. He believed consolidated media ownership could be dangerous for democracy. Boy, did he prove to be right. The Communications Act also determined that technology was an interstate good, like railways and highways, and should be monitored and regulated as such. To implement the Communications Act, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, was created. The FCC's duty was to issue licenses and frequencies to radio operators and to bring order to the burgeoning new industry. They determined ownership by what best served the public interest, requiring diversity in ownership, political discourse, hiring, and programming. Companies broadcasting content considered obscene or profane could be penalized. As such, the FCC had the responsibility of educating the public on the dissemination of news and centralized all the authority pertaining to news and media in the United States. Not everyone agreed with FDR's regulatory approach, but the success of the New Deal was impossible to deny. Day by day, month by month, the United States clawed its way closer and closer to economic recovery, bolstered by FDR's liberal programs, again deemed socialistic by his critics, and focus on benefits for everyday people. He easily won a second term in office. In FDR's acceptance speech for his 1936 nomination, he introduced the term economic royalists to describe the super-rich who wielded enough wealth and power to directly influence American policies. Economic royalists fought against social safety net programs, partly because these social programs were partially funded by levying higher taxes on the rich. This resistance to tax-supported social initiatives would continue for the next several decades and remains a hallmark of today's Republican Party. FDR went on to serve over three terms as president, the only president to be elected four times until his death in 1945. His unmatched popularity was due in large part to his refusal to allow the ultra-rich to dictate the shape of America.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?